I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. This time 10 years ago, nations signed on to a document, a declaration that was, quote, determined to advance the goals of equality, development, and peace for all women everywhere, unquote. 10 years later, people are asking if anything's really changed. The world is a different place. Presidents and prime ministers have come and gone. But is it possible to look at the UN declaration from the Women's Conference in Beijing and conclude if the lives of women really are any better? We're going to talk with three women who bring their own personal experiences and perspectives to this question. We'll hear about Afghanistan, Southern Sudan, and New York City. We'd also like to hear from you. Is there any way to measure if women are further ahead or further behind looking at the past 10 years? Or is that answer one that is still in the hands of men in politics and men in uniform? Are your own experiences part of the answer to this question? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're going to be hearing in just a moment from Southern Sudan, and we're going to hear from New York City, but we're going to start with Rina Amiri, who has spent the past 3 years in Afghanistan. Rina is a member of Women Waging Peace. It's an organization that works with women worldwide, resolving conflicts and improving the lives of women, as I said, for 3 years living and working in Afghanistan. And welcome back to the program. It's been a while.
Thank you, Dick.
I wonder how useful it is with Afghanistan to look at that 10-year period. Because if we look back 10 years, that was just the time when the Taliban were gaining control in that country.
Exactly. And what you saw 10 years ago was in the midst of a civil war where you saw for the first time in Afghan history gender-based violence, gender-based rape as a weapon of war, followed by the Taliban where, as you know, women were deprived of essentially every right, right to education, right to step out of the house without the accompaniment of a male, right to basic education. And in the last 3 years, with the implementation of the Bonn Agreement, what we've seen is significant changes, significant developments. Women went from being not being at all part of the public sector to now having representation from 12% to 25% in the political arena.
Give us an example of the kind of job that a woman would hold in Afghanistan now, which would have been unthinkable under the time of the Taliban. Someone who you know.
Well, for one, one great example is Masuda Jalal. We had a woman presidential candidate 6 months after the implementation of the Bonn Agreement with the convention of the emergency, Loi Jirga. Again, with our first presidential election in the history of the country, we had Masuda Jalal contesting the presidential elections, and I believe she was either number 4 or 5 out of the 18 candidates.
So do we look then at Afghanistan as a success in what's happened since the women set their goals in Beijing, or is the story not quite so simple?
It's an uneven story. Certainly, the statistics that I've cited, the examples that I've illustrated, are women in urban parts of Afghanistan, in Kabul, in Herat, in the major cities of Afghanistan. Women have made significant advances in the political and public arena. Has that meant anything to rural women? Not very much at all. In fact, I would say that the lives of rural women have not changed very much at all in the last 10 years. The type of poverty that they face, the repressive measures, the human rights violation that they continue to confront, the lack of access to basic employment opportunities, education continues to be the same.
Give me an example of a case that you know, a woman whose story would illustrate what you're talking about in rural Afghanistan.
I'll give you an example contrasting urban and rural in one area. For example, in Herat, this is an area that is seen to be a real center of women's activities in some respects. Women have more access to education in Herat than most parts of the country, higher education as well. You have women's organizations, women in the public arena within the city of Herat. At the same time, if you travel just about 2 hours out of Herat or 1 hour out of Herat, you will find that women have not heard very much about the political process. You will find that women still don't have access to basic education, despite the fact that in the last 3 years, we've had over 4 million children gain access to education, and close to 40% of them are women. we still have 70% of women who are deprived of education, and that's largely in rural areas. I have met women in rural areas who've never had access to education. Their mothers haven't, and they continue to face that challenge.
I want to move on to bring my other guests in, but there's one point that I want to try and understand before we do that. My experience in Afghanistan is limited, but my understanding is that some of the women in the rural part of the country live the lives they lead because their fathers and their husbands and their brothers dictate that that's the way things will be, that they cannot have education or they can't leave the house without an escort. That must be something pretty hard to change.
I think there has already been some change in that. When I have traveled to the rural parts of Afghanistan, it is the men actually who appeal to us to build schools for women. They are comfortable with women receiving education up to the sixth grade. After that, it's debated. But up to the sixth grade in far parts of the country where I've gone, they've appealed for that to take place.
I want to see if we can bring in a second guest at this point. Let's hear from Awut Deng Atwil. She is the founder of the Sudanese Women's Association in Nairobi and the Sudanese Women's Voice for Peace. And she's joining us from a studio in New York City. Awut, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
A little bit about your story, and let me start, if I can, with some background. I know your husband was arrested and persecuted and then exiled for criticizing the Sudanese government. You and your children then followed him into exile in Kenya. So would you say that your work with women started then in a refugee camp outside your own country?
That's right. I started to work with women when I came from Sudan in 1984 to join my husband. And we came from a different background, Sudanese women in our country. We go to school in Arabic, and we were faced with a lot of difficulties to even communicate in the refugees camp where we were. So the first struggle was really to look at the women and work hard to unite the women so that they can be able to articulate the problem that we're facing them in a foreign country.
Now, did you do that just one-on-one? You saying, I need something for my children, someone else saying the same sort of thing?
It was actually when we were trying to send our children to school and they had difficulties of how to communicate with the headmistress in the school. And it's like all of us were finding ourselves individually doing that. So we said we cannot actually do it on individual basis, but I think if we organize ourselves, we will not be a nuisance to the Kenyan sisters, but we will be able to build our capacity and be able to look at our children as well. So we actually, from different experience, we joined that and we organized ourselves and we became a Sudanese Women Association in Nairobi in 1987.
Now, your work today takes you back to your country just in the months after a peace agreement has been signed there. Should we look at women in southern Sudan now as having a better life than they did 10 years ago?
I think the women actually started before even the peace agreement. I think the women brought a great leadership in bringing peace in Sudan. We have been struggling to let our voices be heard in the international community. And in our communities, we work very hard on reconciliation and peace. And today, we think that women actually directed this peace agreement that was signed because we started to negotiate the peace between the Northern Sudanese women and the Southern Sudanese women. And we went further to our communities to work on peace and reconciliations where there were conflicts. So
You make it sound like it happens sort of all in shiny white Land Rovers, and I know that it doesn't. I know you work village to village. I'm wondering, Awut, if you can, for our understanding, tell us the story of the kind of woman who's trying to come to terms with a new life after the war.
Of course, we have different categories. The experience of women in this war is different. The women who were abducted and enslaved in Sudan, there were women who were displaced. There were women who lost their children and are left with nothing. So coming from that background is actually trying to rebuild our life from the beginning. And I met this woman last year who was enslaved. She was abducted when she was already 5 years, and she is now 22 years, and she has 6 kids. And I found her, and all what she wants is, where are my relatives? Where are my family? Her father was killed, and her mother went missing. But the determination that she's looking at is like, I want to rebuild my life from the beginning. I want to be in this community where I belong after being away for 17 years in slavery.
Who are the fathers of her children?
The father of her children are Arab tribes. She was forced to have Arab children, and she has these 6 children that come from Arab, but she has to take care of them. So this and there are many examples.
Why doesn't she just want revenge, Awud?
I think the nature of women is actually a protection of life. It doesn't matter, and sometimes it's like confrontations, dialogue with it, and she dialogue with her kids, and because when the kids were asking her, why, where are your relative, and she will say, yes, I don't have relative because your relative killed my relative, and it's like, this is a dialogue. She has to make the children to understand, and the children have to understand what was happening to her. Why did she come across to get the father and have these kids?
I need to stop you there. We're going to come back after a break. A reminder to our listeners, our number is 1-800-423-8255. It is 10 years since women gathered in Beijing to talk about making their lives better in the world. Has it made a difference? 1-800-423-TALK. Has it made a difference to you? I'm Dick Gordon. This is the... I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. With me on the program, Rina Amiri, member of Women Waging Peace, has spent the past 3 years working with women in Afghanistan. Awut Deng Atwil is founder of the Sudanese Women's Association in Nairobi and the Sudanese Women's Voice for Peace. She is directly involved in helping women in southern Sudan improve their lives after 21 years of a war there. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We'd like to have you join the conversation. And it's a good time to bring Lisa Tominelli in. She is director of job retention programs at a program called Dress for Success. It helps low-income women find and maintain jobs. Lisa's joining us from New York City. Hi there.
Thank you. Welcome.
Lisa, you've been doing this kind of work with homeless and single and low-income women now for about 10 years. Is that right?
Absolutely. I've been helping women, low-income women specifically, try to go back to work for the last 10 years in New York City, and now with Dress for Success, more worldwide.
Is it useful to use that 10-year period of your own experience to say, okay, is anything better for these women?
Mm-hmm. Well, it is my personal reference point, and working with the women one-on-one for the last 10 years, I have really not seen their situations change very much, although there is a lot of media attention and seemingly a lot of opportunities. The women I serve still deal with homelessness, finding affordable housing, domestic violence, lack of health care, lack of child care. These are the major barriers to helping them find and maintain employment, and I have not seen that change in the last 10 years.
Is it a lack of attention from leaders? Is it that more and more women are finding themselves in those circumstances? Why would you say that there's been so little improvement?
There's definitely more women, I think, finding themselves in that arena. I think that specifically in New York City, our job market has been severely impacted by world events, and that affects the opportunities afforded to the women here in New York City and across the country. And that what our politicians and our government, I mean, our budgets have gotten smaller and smaller over the last 10 years for the programs that are designed to help women overcome domestic violence, find affordable housing, and find the job training to help them go back to work.
Let me bring Rina Amiri back in here, because Rina, you've spent a lot of time in the United States as well as time in Afghanistan. And when Lisa talks about the priority of finding a job and finding a home and getting an education, these are the same words that you're using to describe what women in Afghanistan are looking for. We think of them as so bizarrely different places, but in many ways some of what we're talking about is exactly the same, isn't it?
Absolutely, and I'm glad that you're bringing this up. I think in the Western media, often what is seen as is the religious element, Islam, or perhaps the whole symbol of the burqa, I think limits our understanding about the challenges that Afghan women face. It is employment. It is poverty. It is a lack of due attention to the situation of women and a marginalization of women's issues that Afghan women face, very much like the United States.
And Awood, when you try to talk about these issues with women in southern Sudan, I mean, are you at the stage where you're talking about getting a better education for girl children, or is it simply helping people find a home and get resettled after the war?
I think in Sudan is not actually different from any other part of the world. I think the women has been deprived from education, not getting health services, not owning land, not owning property. And children, the girl child is seen as a property. He's not supposed to acquire a skill or go to school like a brother. So we are trying to raise these issues in the context of the law, because we do not even have the law that protects the women. So we want to look at the Constitution, and we wanted to see that education is a basic right for all the people. And when I mean all the people, the girl's child and the boy child has to go to school, because they all have future and they all have contribution towards their nation. So, and the health issues is even more critical in our situation, because we have been in war and women has been lacking these facilities. So we have lost number of women. And when I say women, it's a child who is 14 years or 15 years or 16 years being married, and she die on the process when in delivery. So these are the challenges. Even now, when Sudan has signed a peace agreement with the SPLA, whether the these things has to be looked at it and on a special attention, because it's Sudanese women make 60% right now after the war. And we want to see this majority not left behind, but given a special attention, and should be compulsory education for all the Sudanese children, not, you know, the same discrimination and marginalization of women. At the same time, we do not have women who are in the key position in decision-making area, which will actually get involved and look at the women issues critically. But it's a struggle. And it's a challenge, and we are trying to dialogue on that, so that it's a participation, a full participation of these women to make a difference in Sudan, which is emerging out from the war.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. This hour, an opportunity to take kind of a personal, a reflective measure of how far women have come since they gathered in Beijing back in 1995, this time 10 years ago, to talk about establishing certain levels of human rights as women's rights, as human rights, human dignity, equality. Let's take a call from Woburn, Massachusetts, and Lara is joining us. Hi, Lara.
Hi, thank you very much for this program. It's a topic that is very close to my heart. I have been living in the U.S. For part of these past few 10 years, and before that I was living in South Africa. And I have to say that I'm somewhat pessimistic about the progress that's been made, because in these past 10 years I don't recall ever seeing a billboard, well, actually maybe once, seeing a billboard that speaks to the fact that violence against women is wrong. And I think, given that in South Africa more than half the people who suffer from HIV/AIDS are women, and that a lot of them get it because of violence, sexual violence against them, you know, that is something that we should be ashamed of, that we haven't addressed in a more public way. And then here in the U.S., when when I hear the other day that the minimum wage was still not increased, you know, that impacts women and children. So I guess I'm pessimistic. And
yeah, you know, if you do the math on that minimum wage, Lisa, you don't even get anywhere close to what would be the poverty line in New York City, do you?
Absolutely not. And then most women that are earning minimum wage are not even getting benefits. So on top of still living under the poverty level and no benefits, this is the working poor. This is the majority of women in New York City, in America right now, and it's very difficult to pay for childcare, to get pay for medicine. Asthma has a large prevalence in our low-income women's families.
And I'm curious about something, and I'd love to hear Lisa, Rena, and Abud all speak to this, and that is that I'm wondering if over the past 10 years, when we measure improvements in the quality of lives for women, we measure them largely on the strength of non-governmental organizations rather than governments. Let me start here with Rena in the Connection studio. I'm not using this as a chance to, whack any Western government or even the brand new government in Afghanistan, but it seems to me that a lot of what is accomplished by people, ordinary people who get committed to an idea and an organization and work at that level rather than the politicians.
That's absolutely true. And particularly in Afghanistan, what we've seen in the last 3 years, for example, just in Kabul, over 50 women's organizations, women reaching out to other women. The effect of that has been that the government, to some extent, has not taken the responsibility that it needs to and addressing some of these grave issues. We have a Ministry of Women's Affairs, but to some extent what has resulted is a marginalization of women's issues. Instead of having it mainstreamed across mm-hmm. the government, there is a tendency to center upon the Ministry of Women's Affairs to solve all of women's problems, despite the fact that they make 60% of the population, and the entire government should be responsible for the situation of women as well as men.
And Awut, there's an illustration from your own experience about the way that women from different parts of Sudan, tribes that are seen to have been battling each other, the women just sort of push that aside. How is that possible? How do you get past the men and their desire to keep battle lines up to get women solving these kinds of problems?
I think we do not have a responsible government in Sudan. The government of Sudan has been a government that has been killing its own citizens. The bombs have been dropped on us. So we really, the government did not even think of the Beijing as a foundation where he could take up and address the issues of the women. But I think the government has been very hostile to Southern Sudanese people and particularly the women. And I think what happened is that even our voices to be heard today is a great thing. Is because we had the connection with Swani, Ambassador Swani Han, mm-hmm. because Sudanese women have been crying in darkness and in the bush where the voices could not even reach international community to even raise our flight. But I think it's very right that the people has been trying to work hard, the women in particular, not to be divided, but look at the common issues that are affecting them and affecting their children and affecting the families. We were left to take care of our kids and all the men were in the battlefield. So we did not have a choice, but really to put whatever men, because it's not the women who were making war. We were not a decision to make that war, but we were affected by the decision which was made by men. So we had to work hard to take care of our children and to take care of even our husband who are in the battlefield. So I think we were able to reach the women more than the government of Sudan who was dropping bomb on us. And the SPLA is a liberation movement that has not really paid attention to needs of the women, but focus in liberations and the fighting in the battlefield. So it was actually people to people in Sudan that were able to dialogue, were able to address, were able to listen to the needs of their sisters and brothers in all over the place. So up to today, we are still looking forward what the government of Sudan is going to be bold to look critically for the country that has been ruined by war for the last 40 years. and all of us. I grew up in war, and I was born in war. And my kids, again, followed the same line, and I want to see a different Sudan. I don't want to see my children going to... At least they have the experience that they were born outside the country, they lost their father, and they have been raised with a mother, with no uncle, with no father. But I wanted a better Sudan, that they will actually enjoy the fruits of their mothers who has been working hard to see a different coming to Sudan.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We'd like to have you join our conversation as we assess the past 10 years since the Beijing Women's Declaration at the UN conference there. 1-800-423-TALK. Lisa Tominelli, have you sort of at a state where, or at a position where you say, you know, it's just the help we get from the city or the state or the national level isn't going to make a difference. It's what people, ordinary people, do for us that really helps.
Well, in the case of Dress for Success, we do not receive government funding, and we really rely heavily upon volunteers to help us fulfill our mission. And I think that just in the last 10 years, it really has been the one-on-one work that the staff of the nonprofits and the volunteers that contribute their time and resources have really led to changes. I think our government has made these social problems truly an economic issue, and tried to bottom line it to make it seem like we shouldn't help. And when you start working people, giving people examples of the women's issues and the domestic violence and the homelessness and the inability to find work, and there's such a pressure in the United States to define yourself through what you do 9 to 5.
Mm-hmm. So do you just give up on government? Do you just say, really, it is going to be organizations like ours that don't rely on government assistance that are going to make a difference for the people who need it?
I mean, I think that you can affect change in two ways, working within your system, working outside your system, and it depends upon your resources and ability to, make that decision. And in a perfect world, it'd be great to work with the government, and I'd hate to think that, Just for Success or any nonprofit's given up on working with the government, but sometimes it's easier to assess the resources you have locally and go from there, because women are knocking on your door literally and saying, I need help. I can't go home. I don't have a home. I need health care. I need to find work. I need to feed my children. And so they come first.
1-800-423-8255 is the number to join us. Let's go to Fitchburg, Massachusetts for our next call. And Diana's with us. Hi, Diana.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm fine. So how do you measure the past 10 years?
I think a lot of I see a lot of improvement on women's roles. And then I'm myself a housewife. I just started my job as staff accountant. And then I also finished my college. And then I'm lucky I have a husband who support me, and then my parents who support me. And my mom also has a master degree. However, I see the most of a challenge, actually, the woman itself.
Women making it difficult for other women?
Yes.
In what way?
I'm from Indonesia. When I was in Indonesia, when a woman really drive to move forward and then build a career, and then some woman will put, hold on, put the brake on. You are a woman. That's not your nature. Your nature is go to school, and then maybe you work 2 or 3 years, and after that you married, and then stay home, take care of your husband, and then have a children.
Do you find that same thing here in America, Diana?
Yes, I do. I see actually a contrast during the elections about Howard Dean's wife. We know that she's a doctor. And then I heard several women say that, oh, where is his wife? I said to myself, for God's sake, his wife is working and then helping other people. And then I heard that some women say that, she cannot be a first lady then, so she has to do this one and this one, support his wife. For me, that's like contradiction. It is sad, quite often I see that actually the biggest challenge on the woman movement is woman itself.
Well, there's a challenge for you, Connection listeners. Is in fact that the case from your perspective? Is it women who work also against women when we talk about ways of improving life? And does that also show up in the developing world as well as the developed world? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. 10 years since women gathered in Beijing to talk about improving the lives of women right across the world. Every woman, everywhere, I think is how they stated it there. So we thought we'd try and do the same thing by looking not just at countries far away from the United States, but at this one as well. Lisa Tominelli is joining us from New York City. She's a director of Dress for Success. It's a program helping low-income women there. Awut Deng Adwil is with us. She is the winner of the prestigious Interaction Humanitarian Peace Award for her work helping women in southern Sudan. And Rina Amiri, member of Women Waging Peace, and for the past 3 years living and working in Afghanistan. I wonder, Rina, if I could just get a quick word from you, a reflection on what Diana was saying with her thought that maybe, in fact, it's women who often cause the problems for other women.
I think we need to get to the root of why that is in some cases. In Afghanistan and in many developing countries, what you find is that women are competing for scarce resources. When the pie is very small and they're looking to the same donors, to the same few positions in government, then it is within their interest to undermine each other. At the same time, what we've seen in Afghanistan, particularly after the Taliban era, is that women have realized that to protect their own interests, they have to organize together, they have to coalesce. And you've seen the beginning of a grassroots movement in the last 3 years that extends throughout the country.
Does it become a political movement eventually? Is that something that you can imagine happening? Or does it succeed only really at the grassroots level?
I think that we have elements of both right now. For example, when Masoud Jalal was running for president, you did have a great deal of support for her among Afghan women. So there is a beginning of a political consciousness in Afghanistan. And the Ministry of Women's Affairs has also played a very significant role in raising consciousness that women have to think about their interests as women and come together.
1-800-423-8255 to South Carolina now, and Linda's with us. Hi, Linda.
Good morning.
Thanks for calling. What do you think?
Thank you for taking my call. I think it's a very interesting topic. I wish that we spoke more about it. And what I was really talking about is I'm thinking more, I'm more concerned with what's going on in our country. I'm 50 years old, and I went to college during the time when there was a lot of movement for women. And I think we were making a lot of strides going forward. And what really worries me, and I have four daughters, what really worries me is the direction I feel that we're going now, and I really feel like we're going backwards. It worries me that a woman can't make a decision on her own body as far as abortion, and 60% of the people that are for against abortion are the men making the decision for a woman on her body, and a lot of and not just abortion, but a lot of other issues. Also worries me a little bit this religious movement that we have going on in our country right now, because a lot of it, the background for strong Christianity is the man is the leader and the woman is almost secondary. And that worries me a little bit as far as the direction that the country is going in a whole.
It's an interesting observation about watching women make certain steps forward in this country and wondering if now some of that ground has been lost, at least in terms of the priority of those issues. Lisa Tominelli in New York, what do you think?
I agree. I think that it is difficult for women now to have 100% control over the decisions that affect them. And, you know, when I work with these low-income women, they are too focused on getting their basic needs met. We did do a huge voter registration campaign this year through Dress for Success, and I think that we need to do more of that, and we need to do more education, and we need to get more women running for offices.
Let me hear from Awut on this, because Awut, my understanding is that in your experience, when you tried to get directly involved in peace negotiations, the men basically elbowed you out, and I'm wondering if just trying to be heard, it takes up a lot of energy for women in southern Sudan.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of education to go with that, because it's not really easy for women to get into the decision and be able to make a decision right now. But I think it's a process. It's a process that has to take a lot of education among the men and among the women, because our society is a male-dominated society. And these are the people who have been sitting there for centuries. They have never seen potential that women can be leaders, women can make a contribution. And I think that has stuck into the mind of our men. And it's really, to them, it's not that we cannot make a contribution, but also you look at the element of fear, the power. A power is going to go away from me, and it's like I have to hold into this power by marginalizing this group, mm-hmm. not to participate. So
even if this group is wives and mothers and sisters,
that's exactly, because it's actually boiled down to your sister, to your wife, to your daughter. But still, you don't create an opportunity to let the person grow and develop. It's like I will make a decision on your behalf, and I will do everything on your behalf. And I think is the society now in Sudan is changed by war, because 10 out of 10 families, you will get 8 families are headed by a wife or by a woman, because of the war has taken men, and maybe 2 families will be there. There's a man who is sitting there. So I think it's a big challenge for us now in Sudan, really to reflect and sit and dialogue and see that there is a change, because whether you keep the women in the house, then at the end of the day, that family will have no progress. They would not even send the boys to school.
Yeah.
If a woman does not work in public, or he does not do her business, or he does not make a decision, or she's not in the process of the planning. And this is a big challenge. It's really a big challenge. And I feel it's a process. And it's a process that need to look at creating awareness among the women and among the men, to understand each other, to have a relationship that is understood by everybody.
All right, let's go back to our callers, to Holden, Massachusetts. Christine's on the phone. Hi, Christine.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. The point I'd like to make is that we women in the West tend to think about ourselves as enlightened, and we feel pity for these poor women, in Sudan and in these terrible, countries. But personally, I have been very moved by what your Somalian guest said, the story about this woman who had been enslaved and still is going to take care of the 6 children that were,
that were she was fathered forced. By her enemies, yes.
Yes, yes. And I think that we have lessons to learn from these women. In that case, a lesson of life, of resilience, and of courage.
Let me turn to Rena here in the studio with me. We've not really talked about the great long history of war that Afghanistan has been through, but most of the men that you would meet are men who have lived and knowing only war in Afghanistan. You go back through all the days, all the years of the Mujahideen fighting, the Russians before that. Does that mean that even in Afghanistan there may be a moment now when there are households headed by women, or women who have been doing the work of leading the family, who can turn that into some kind of long-lasting decision-making power? It's what Christine is saying in part, but it's not just limited to places like southern Sudan, is it?
No, you're absolutely right. What we've seen in Afghanistan is through either active mobilization or through forced conscription, the majority of men have been involved in war in some way. And as in Sudan, you do have a significant number of women-headed households. Does that translate into giving them the necessary authority, the necessary resources to play an effective role? Women are keenly aware of the change in dynamics in Afghan society, the change in women's roles as a result of the war, and are communicating this amongst themselves and are attempting to get that heard at the policy level. Unfortunately, I don't think at this point that we have seen that more resources or more authority is given to women because of this change of dynamics. There isn't proper awareness at this point.
Do you know what's preventing that happening?
Certainly the decades of a very radicalized period of war and regime change has set in some very firm gender lines between men and women in Afghanistan, and that's been to some extent difficult to change in the last couple of years. There's also been competing agendas where the political priorities have been the center of attention, mm-hmm. and a lack of due attention, I think, to some of the societal changes that have taken place.
Go back to our phone lines to Worcester, Massachusetts. Lisa's with me. Hi, Lisa. What do you think?
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. First of all, I'd like to agree with the breaking the cycle of cultural stereotypes and gender roles. I'm a financial advisor for a nonprofit organization in Washington, D.C. that works in the African-American community with about 40 families that are 200% below the poverty line. And one of our missions is to educate the young people in our program, both boys and girls. We have a young women's program to help them understand what they can do and who they are in relation to each other.
Are you telling them that they are perhaps further ahead or with more looking at more opportunities than existed for them 10 years ago, Lisa?
Well, I don't think so. I think I agree with your guest who mentioned a while ago that she didn't seem to see any change in New York City. I think in Washington, D.C., it's the same situation, possibly even worse. The school systems there are incredibly worse off than they were 10 years ago as far as funding and testing and achievement for the students. There's a high illiteracy rate. But also my other point that I'd like to make is about the people who work in these nonprofits. You've discussed government versus private funding. Most of our funding does come from private sources, but our staff, our small staff, are either volunteer or if they're paid, they themselves are at the poverty level. And we're talking about young professional, mostly women, who have given up careers for the moment in their chosen professions, who are living at poverty level themselves because of funding for these types of efforts, even in the United States, we're talking about in our capital, Washington, D.C.
You know, a part of it is, though, how the next generation is directed. I know you have, what, 7 children, is that right?
Yes.
How do you explain all this to them, what their mother is doing and what it might mean for them? Do you say that you're working for Sudan? Do you say you're working for them? And what really do you think you can promise them now?
Yeah, I think my work started when my son started to ask me questions that I could not have answers for. My son was 3 years old, and he started asking me, when are we going back to Sudan? And how long is this war going to take? And it's like, it was like a simple question from him, but I thought it was very difficult to find an answer. And that really pushed me to say that, I must work for a change. And how do I explain to them? Is like they already know. They have not seen the Sudan. They have been hearing Sudan, but none of them was born in Sudan. And how can I take them back if I don't work for a change in Sudan? So my simple explanations, I'm leaving you here in Kenya in exile, and I'm going back to do some work with our communities, with our people, and that will take us back to Sudan. And they have been very supportive. I have my daughter who is now 4 years. She has been with me for a full year, traveling all over America and Europe and Africa and inside bushes in southern Sudan, even in areas that are burned not to go in by the government of Sudan. I have taken risks with her and go into those areas. So the support that I get from them is really to explain to them, we cannot go back to Sudan if all of us don't make a contribution. And I think the support I get from them, that's what carry me to go to even risk areas to work with our communities. And that is the understanding. In any time I go out, they know my mom is going to help our communities and is helping us also to go back to Sudan. And also is that if I don't do this work that I earn a very little money from, then they will not go to school. They will not have a shelter to sleep. They will not have a clothing. And that is a whole thing from the family level to the community level. And that is the understanding between my family and the experience they have that they lost the father and I'm the only breadwinner in the family. There was no way that I was going to sit in the house with them and survive.
You know, Rena, as I listen to Awut describe the circumstances that she goes through with her children, working separate from them, I know that you're somewhat ruthless in your work in Afghanistan as well. I'm thinking that these world conferences, declarations and things don't really change things. It's wars that change things. It's conflict and it's people cleaning up after those kinds of messes. That's what determines the, you know, how well women can do or how difficult it is for them.
Well, the conferences are important in terms of creating a global dialogue. I think that is part of the paradigm change, that it's significant to the paradigm change. But in terms of real change, it is at the individual level. It is each individual looking back to themselves and saying, what is my responsibility? I'm an Afghan woman also who left as a child because of the conflict situation and ended up going back because what haunted me often here is, what if my family had not been fortunate enough to leave and to have the resources to leave the situation of war? Who would I be?
Would you be?
Who would I be? Where would I be? Would I have been under a virtual house prison during the period of the Taliban? And who would have helped me? And that has really mobilized me to do the type of work that I'm doing in Afghanistan. So I think the activists that I've met at Women Waging Peace all have taken it to the personal level of connecting their own sense of responsibility to the community and to the global level.
And the three of you have demonstrated once again on the program that those personal stories and personal reflections are really what help us understand change and change that is not taking place. Rena, thanks a lot for coming in.
Thank you.
Rena Amiri's been working in Afghanistan to increase women's participation in politics. Awut Deng Atwil, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Awut is founder of the Sudanese Women's Association in Nairobi. And Lisa Tominelli, appreciate your spending some time with us on the phone as well.
You're welcome.
Lisa's director of the job retention programs at Dress for Success. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.